Welcome to Paradigm Shifters, and we have one of our favorite nutritional, what is it you call yourself? Health detective. We have a health detective on the line with us today, Jim Emke, who's known for structured water and also a long history on exploring the effects of nutrition and how to make you and I well. And Jim uses, the technique you use as a health detective is often hair analysis, right, Jim? Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Veronica. It's good to be back again. Well, I do a lot of work with different types of testing modalities. Certainly hair analysis is one of them because, you know, measuring minerals in the body is not very well done through the blood. I mean, you can do some minerals. You can measure the mineral status of certain minerals in the blood, but a lot of minerals don't really reveal themselves in the blood because the blood is so regulated. You know, it's homeostatic, meaning the body wants to keep the blood stable no matter what. So you'll see, for example, calcium's a classic example. Blood calcium doesn't tell you anything about the bones, doesn't tell you anything about the tissues or the calcium status of the body. The blood calcium level is so important that the parathyroid gland will maintain it even if it has to pull calcium out of the bones and put the calcium in the blood. Because the blood is much, much more important than the bones, and the body can waste calcium from the bones, called calcium resorption, for decades before the bones become osteoporotic. So, you know, you can't really measure calcium in the blood. You have to go into the tissues, and there's where hair excels. It really gives you good impressions about tissue mineral levels. And it's not just the individual minerals that are tested, and toxic metals, I might mention, you know, lead, cadmium, arsenic, mercury, nickel, aluminum, chromium, et cetera. Not chromium, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But not only does it reveal the heavy metals and the nutritional elements, but it also gives you the mineral ratios. And the ratios between the elements, the minerals, is very revealing and provides really good insight into the metabolism.
Hmm. But is that because hair has protein, right? And it grows at such a rate we can actually see it almost dynamically interact. Is that so?
Yeah, it is. And hair is an interesting chronological indicator of our biochemistry. In fact, it's the ultimate drug test, which many of your listeners probably are aware of. In fact, trucking companies, they don't even bother with urine tests. They go right to hair.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't know that.
Oh, hair is the ultimate drug test. Goodness gracious. I had a case years ago when our clinic was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We were there for 25 years. I grew up in Wisconsin for 50 years. And I had a client who was a wealthy man who was buying expensive insurance policies, life insurance policies, to secure his estate so that the taxes on his estate wouldn't cripple his family that inherited the estate. And that's pretty common practice with wealthy people. And he flunked the drug test. They did a urine test on him, and they came up with cocaine.
Hmm.
And so they denied the policy, but his attorney called and said that he denied the use of cocaine, and they wanted to retest. So the insurance company got back to him and said, sure, we'll do a retest, but we want to do hair. And so they wanted to do, the client and his attorney wanted to do a hair toxicology anonymously so that they could see what the results were going to be before they submitted the hair sample, you know, before they submitted to letting the insurance company do the hair sample. So I just referred him to a lab that does hair toxicology because I'm not talking about hair toxicology or drugs. We're doing it for nutritional purposes, but hair is an amazing chronological.
So did he get in trouble? Tell us the rest of the story, Mr. Detective.
it turns out that they denied that they wouldn't retest, and so I gather that he would have shown the cocaine, and so the whole thing was dropped, and so his insurance policy didn't go through.
Oh, wow. Hey, wow.
Yeah, if there was a test out there that Big Brother, quote-unquote, could abuse, mm-hmm. it would definitely be hair analysis. You can tell so much about what a person's been eating, whatever medications they've been taking. You can see, based upon the hair rate of growth.
Well, what's happening these days? Are people using this more? Is it becoming a bigger thing then?
Oh, it is. Hair analysis. I mean, I started doing hair analysis back in the late 70s. In 76, I think, is when we started doing hair chemistries because you know, I've been in this field for over 40 years. And so in those days, it was a slow growth process. Hair analysis was kind of coming into its own. It was developing momentum. And the more I worked with it, the more impressed I became. And then a lot of the bad labs, because a bunch of labs tried to capitalize on it. And And over years, it was sorted out. Now it's pretty much down to just a handful of labs that really do high-quality hair analysis and that specialize in hair analysis. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not talking hair toxicology or drugs. I'm talking nutritional implications of hair chemistry and health implications. And a lot of that is revealed in the ratios. You know, the calcium-phosphorus ratio tells you a lot about the nervous system in the bones. You know, the calcium-potassium ratio gives you insight into thyroid function. Hmm. Sodium-magnesium ratio gives you insight into the adrenal function. You know, calcium-magnesium ratio gives you insight into glucose stability. Zinc-copper ratio gives you insight into steroid hormone chemistry.
So what about, for example, mental health things or Alzheimer's and that sort of thing? Do you see in hair analysis propensities because of the predominance of certain toxic chemicals? And I don't know how it would show, but do you see neurological problems or mental health problems coming up?
You can. The big thing with Alzheimer's, of course, is aluminum toxicity. And, you know, they've made the connection between aluminum and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other neuromuscular diseases for decades, but nobody's really, in the medical community, has really been wanting to take a deep look at that. When aluminum first appeared as a common toxin in brain disorder diseases, the whole rationale of the medical community is, well, the blood-brain barrier should prevent that aluminum from getting into the brain, so there must be a malfunction in the blood-brain barrier, which might be the case. But we could also take a look at our aluminum intake. You know, that would be another obvious logical extension. Aluminum cookware, antiperspirants are loaded with aluminum, not deodorants typically, but antiperspirants. Aluminum is used a lot as an anti-caking agent in salt and sugar and powder and talcum powders and stuff
and
like that.
And still, huh?
It still is, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any real restrictions that have occurred with aluminum. Because the most obvious restriction would be, first of all, antiperspirants. You know, women shave their arms so their pores are open and irritated. And then they paint the, you know, armpit with aluminum chlorhydride or, you know, the aluminum that's found in antiperspirants. So, yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
But we used to live like this. Oh, they wouldn't sell if it wasn't okay.
Well, there is the old Delaney Amendment. Some of the old-timers will remember that because when I first started getting into this field in the early 70s, the Delaney Amendment is what the alternative practitioners of that era hung their hat on because the Delaney Amendment said it was illegal to add any known carcinogen to the food supply.
Oh, you're kidding.
It is illegal, according to the Delaney Amendment, to add a carcinogen to the food supply. So that really restricted food industries and drug industries from, you know, going too far with carcinogens that are added to the food supply. And then about 10 years ago, it was repealed, maybe 15 years ago. You'd have to Google it. But if you Google the Delaney Amendment, D-E-L-A-N-E-Y.
I will. Mm-hmm.
He was a congressman. I don't know what state he was from, maybe California, but I'm not sure offhand. But in those days, people said, yeah, you know, it makes perfect sense. We should have a law that it's illegal to add a carcinogen to food. What could be more logical than that and simple? And they really restricted a lot of chemicals and things that were coming out that they wanted to add to food. And now it's open. They repealed the Delaney Amendment. It's no longer on the books. But Google it. It's a fascinating subject for sure.
And who repealed it? Who do we know that repealed it?
The federal government, the Congress and the Senate, you know, the House and the Senate of the United States repealed it.
Wow. What is wrong with us?
It was a federal law, and then it was repealed. You know, when my wife was a nutrition instructor at the University of Wisconsin, Karen, as I think you know, has a master's in nutritional science from UW, mm-hmm. Was a nutrition instructor at the university, was a dietitian and all that. She got a little bit of hot water with her boss because she, you know, emphasized to her students. She taught nutrition to nursing students primarily, or anybody. It was an elective class, but nursing students had to take it. So her point was that, okay, so these food chemicals, they're studied individually, you know, red dye, yellow dye, green, whatever, preservatives, benzoate, this, that, or whatever.
Right.
None of them are studied together. It's like pharmaceuticals, you know, so these pharmaceuticals are studied together, but when you're working with somebody who's on six different medications, nobody knows the interaction of those medications. And Karen's point was that when you eat a half a dozen or a dozen different food chemicals at a meal, they're interacting as a team. Hmm. And they've been studied individually, but they've never been studied collectively on how they interact with each other.
And now, so that's interesting to me, because if I take a supplement or a herbal supplement that's got four or five things in it, even if they're all healthy things, I usually have a problem. So that,
yeah,
just carry that to another extreme, right?
Yeah, and you can certainly apply the same logic to the to the world of natural remedies, you know. And like classical homeopathic remedies are always singular remedies. And then we have what's called mixed homeopathy, where you add a variety of different homeopathic remedies to get treat symptoms. And, you know, a real purist homeopath, classically trained, would find real problems with the mixing of different remedies to treat symptoms, mm-hmm. whereas with the classical remedies, you're treating the constitution of the person. So you could apply that logic to a lot of different areas.
But if you go back into hair analysis, don't hold that thought. I don't want to lose that. If you go back into hair analysis, can you see through the analysis how you particularly are integrating or working with a combination of things? Does that show up as well, or is that too intricate?
That's a little too intricate. You know, you're not going to be able to detect from hair analysis if you're mixing sodium benzoate with red dye number 5 or something like that, and it's a bad combination. No. But you will get impressions on toxic metals, for sure.
Okay.
And you'll get real distinct impressions on tissue mineral levels and the ratios, which tell you so much about the person's biochemistry.
Hmm. So it's also in interaction with your own, your natural, your personal biochemistry, right?
Right, exactly. And my preference is to do both blood and hair, because that way I get a good impression from a blood test about the things that are discernible in blood testing, you know, like lipids and electrolytes and enzymes and liver function and kidney function and things of that nature. And then you combine that with the hair chemistry, which gives you a different level of insight, as well as the nutritional status of the minerals and the implications associated with the mineral ratios and the toxic metals, and you have a really good starting point. I also like to work a lot with hormone profiles and, you know, saliva and urine and stool testing, because, you know, so much emphasis on the gut and the health of the gut. And when you look at stool chemistries, it's pretty shocking, the kind of organisms, the good, the bad, and the ugly that you find in stool tests. So from my perspective, relative to health detective work, I like to integrate all of those factors. And it depends on the needs of the individual, of course.
So, like, if somebody comes in who's, I don't know, maybe she's had autistic children, or somebody else has got a neurological, like a depression or something, what mm-hmm. would you do? Would you do hair analysis first?
Well, if I had to pick and choose, depending upon the situation with what you're describing, yes, I would do hair first, because that kind of a profile, very little is going to be revealed in a classic blood chemistry or blood count. You know, there's two basic panels in medical blood testing. There's the blood chemistry, which they're now calling comprehensive metabolic profile or panel, and then there's the CBC with the differential or the complete blood count. And that's all basic information. It's good information, but it's not going to dig deep into specific problems like you mentioned. Whereas hair is going to give you more insight into that. If I have the leeway to do both, I'll do both. But if I have to, in that kind of a case, the scenario that you described, if I have to choose one or the other for cost reasons or whatever, I'll do the hair first, because it's going to give me more insight.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. Also, do you think, this is part of the reason I get excited talking to you, but do you think there's a shift going on amongst people? Like, what is the community experiencing? Are we having more mental health situations, more memory loss, more ADD, is there anything like that going on, or is, you know?
Well, I would say that it's on an accelerated curve upwards. You know, it's like there's so much going on with dementia and Alzheimer's disease and neuromuscular diseases and Parkinson's, and it's clearly a sign of our time, because these conditions were so rare when we were kids. I mean, I'm 67, so I was born in 1950, and I mean, I never even heard of autism. I mean, it was non-existent. When I went to schools in Milwaukee, we had what were called special C classes, which were kids that were a little slow. You know, they just didn't quite get the academic world in the same way that the rest of us did, and they were few and far between. And now, you know, the rate of autism is so incredibly aggressive that if you see the movie Vaxxed, V-A-X-X-E-D, which I highly recommend, you can just Google Vaxxed the movie, mm-hmm. and you can rent it or just view it on YouTube. The current rate of increase in autism continues unabated. By 2030, 1 out of 3 children will be autistic. So that's just looking at the statistics. So, I mean, that's the death of the culture. I mean, there's just simply no way you can sustain this culture if 1 out of 3 children is autistic. It's not going to happen.
But I think there's another thing here, and maybe we don't want to get into a political thing, but to me it's revolting that the information that is brought up can't be used because they don't want to break into the markets.
Yeah, I don't see why you want to avoid the politics of that, Veronica. No, just kidding.
Well, I really get upset about it because we're doing it to our people. We don't look after our people. And here's people like you and even me trying to help like mad, right?
Yeah, it's a real dilemma because the politics and the economics of the politics dominate the science and dominate logic and common sense and dominate any kind of proactivity that would reverse the trend. So
now people get killed over making a fuss, right?
Well, that's if you're looking through the internet, yeah, you'll find all sorts of articles that are suggesting that people that have really resisted, you know, the alternative docs that have really become fairly well known, a bunch of them are ending up dead. So there's controversy about that too, about how, why are all these alternative practitioners ending up dead and under many suspicious circumstances, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's another subject for another day, and it does get pretty political, and, you know, I really don't want to go there too much because I don't know actually what's going on at that level, but I do know that the economics and the politics involved is ruthless mm-hmm. and is extremely profitable. It's not even
for
scientific.
Some.
I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. look at the flu shot. It's a guessing game. So they're guessing as to the strain, you know, like when the next cold and flu season comes the next fall, they're going to say, well, we got to make a couple hundred million batches of flu shot vaccine. So we don't know what the strain is going to be. We have to make these vaccines ahead of time. So let's take a guess. And mm-hmm. that's what they do.
And, I suppose some people would benefit from those things. I mean, I walk around them, they will give them a wide girth, right? But some people, I suppose, would benefit, but a lot of us don't, really, right?
Well, I'm not even sure about the benefits, but that's probably the case. There are people that benefit from the flu shot or, you know, various vaccines, but it's so over the top in my estimation. You know, when I went to school, we got polio and smallpox, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's probably what you had, too.
Mm-hmm. I did.
And now they want to give kids, you know, 25 to 30 vaccines before they enter kindergarten. I mean,
now, something
insane.
Interesting about that is you just spoke of how when things are combined, some people can't handle them.
Right. Good point.
And there we give them 25 vaccinations in a shot. I'm like, holy mackerel.
Well, not in one shot, but there are mixed vaccines for MMR is the classic one, you know, mumps, measles, rubella. And basically that's the vaccine that's been indicted relative to Parkinson's.
Oh.
I used to get the Wisconsin Autistic League in Madison back when I lived in Wisconsin. And every single mother that came up to me after the talk said that their boy, it's 80% boys, was developing perfectly normally until they got the MMR vaccine. And they came home and they were drooling. And they, you know, the next day they couldn't focus. They couldn't maintain eye contact. They're drooling. They're barely. And, you know, the first time I ever heard of this, and this is an interesting thing, was back in 99. And CNN, believe it or not, did a news special, what do they call it, segment, on these group of pediatricians in New England who were up in arms about the increases in autism that they were seeing after vaccinations, and they were really concerned, and they wanted to investigate this. And so it was the actual conventional media was onto this in that way back then, and I actually contacted Charlie Dubois, who's the president of Standard Process, which is one of the most successful professional line supplement companies in the United States, and told him about it because I saw this on a Sunday afternoon. And Charlie actually went through his contacts and got a transcript, because this was before computers. You know, I mean, it wasn't before computers, but it was before everybody was on computers and everything was done digital. And Charlie went through the effort to get an actual transcript of the program. And
probably on snail mail, too.
Yeah, exactly. And mm-hmm. I just wish I had saved that. I did for a while, and right, I don't know where it is now, but that was actually initiated by a group of pediatricians who were noticing this immediate cause and effect, like this kid. And then what they showed on CNN was this, they interviewed a couple parents, and they had, you know, that was the age of camcorders like today, where you instead of, you know, taking pictures like when I was a kid and when our kids were kids, everybody was has a camcorder.
Mm-hmm.
And so they show this picture of this perfectly normal 18-month-old child in the high chair, you know, happy, playing, patty cake, whatever. And then the next day after the MMR vaccine, the same child in the same high chair is drooling and can't function, can't maintain eye focus.
Oh, my gosh. How heartbreaking.
Exactly.
How heartbreaking. So the proof is right there, eh?
To me, that's not proved scientifically. It's an anecdotal situation, but like some of my teachers have said over the years, there are good anecdotes and there are bad anecdotes, you know. Just because it's an anecdote doesn't mean it doesn't have some validity or it shouldn't be studied. I mean, to me, that's powerful anecdotal evidence when your child's perfectly normal one day, and then you get the MMR vaccine, which again is mixed, you know, vaccinations, and it blows out the immune system, and there's mercury and aluminum and all the, you know, all the toxin, the poisonous preservatives that are put in there. And the next day your child is drooling and can't function and, you know, is completely autistic in 24 hours.
So that might be anecdotal, but I mean, like, what do you need? We've got some evidence. Somebody got sick from this.
Well, and then ironically, it's the pediatricians in New England who brought it to the attention of the media and wanted to shed some light on the whole theme and opened it up. And then, of course, once the whole thing started to open up, the powers that be, so to speak, you know, they just shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was going to say about Milwaukee and in California, when our kids, see, Wisconsin has personal exemption privileges, so we never vaccinated our kids.
Okay.
And there was a measles scare outbreak in the Milwaukee public school system when our kids were in elementary school. And so there was a rush to the legislature. Let's repeal the personal exemption privilege, you know. And then they found out that half the kids that contracted measles had been vaccinated.
Wow.
So half of them were vaccinated and half of them weren't.
Isn't that interesting? Now,
exactly.
When I was a kid in the olden days, we all got the measles and we made a party out of it. And then once you got the measles, you knew you couldn't get them again.
Yeah, exactly.
But we had
and
several
measles,
different strains,
you know,
of them.
Right. So, well, what I was going to say, also, that's the same thing that happened in California with the Disneyland outbreak of measles. But they kept it secret until about 6 months ago that approximately half of those kids that contracted measles at Disneyland were vaccinated, you know, but they didn't release that information until they got the legislature to repeal the personal exemption privileges in California. And then they revealed, you know, that approximately half the kids that contracted the measles were vaccinated. There's so much politics and economics, and that's generally going to distort things. And it's unfortunate, but that's the nature of human nature.
Well, our human, they don't really care that much about our individual. They care about the profit part, right?
Well, it would sure appear to be the case. I mean, we all have to have an economic reality and make a living and, you know, show a profit or whatever the case might be. But, gosh, you just hope there would be some sense of moral or ethical compulsion there that would say, you know, we got to draw a line somewhere. We can't just sacrifice the health of everybody for the sake of profit.
Well, I think there's another thing, which is called progress. Like, well, I wonder what would happen if we really worked at like knowing how to make humans really help humans be really healthy. Wouldn't we gain in a huge profit when people are more productive because they're well and they're getting older well and all that, you know?
Sure, I know. I mean, that would be an idyllic situation. But if you don't have that vision that you just pictured, and your vision is more short term, then then it's profit rules, you know, and then you don't worry about the long term. You're looking at the short term, and right in the short term, it's how much money are you making?
Losing
money. You know, the drug companies would lose tremendous profits if vaccines became optional, for example, across the board. And the food industry would have to deal with tremendous loss of profits if certain chemicals and things were banned, at least temporarily, until things, you know, readjusted. But they don't see the long haul, and maybe they don't get the social picture, what I call the moral and ethical picture. But, you know, everybody's thinking more in terms of, like, what's the immediate future, and that's based on profit.
And how much can I make? Well, so let me ask you this. Is that, well, like, we've got too many people having, like, mental health problems, anxiety, not just autism, but it's like ADD, PTSD, and we've got so many vets and so on. But I know that there are some huge breakthroughs going on as well. Can you tell us some of the stuff that's helping people over here who aren't spending their time right in the mainstream?
Sure. I can touch on a couple
areas. You broke out of mainstream years ago. I know you did.
Yeah, I don't know if I was ever in mainstream, but I think that made it easy for me. But
for listeners, in case you don't know this, Jim broke away at about 20. Give him a quick thumbnail on that, because that is how people get out of it, isn't it?
Yeah, for me, it was a personal health situation where I had chronic boils from puberty until my early 20s, and they weren't all the time, you know, one after the other, but they would cycle, and they went on for years and years and years. And then in the summer, I had really bad allergies, a hay fever to the extreme. That's what everybody called it then, but it was just a combination of bad allergies that would lead to wheezing fits where I could barely get my breath, which is an asthmatic thing, but in those days, I never went to a doctor. You know, nobody ever diagnosed it. It was only happened in the summer, and it was exercise-induced, you know, that kind of thing. So I just learned to live with it. And then I met my mentor when I was 22 years old, and he put me on a 7-day fast and cleansing program, and he had me repeat it at the change of the season, so 4 times a year. And after one cleansing program, I stopped having boils for the rest of the year.
Did you hate it? Did you hate doing it?
Do I hate doing the cleansing program? No.
No, at the beginning, did you?
Mm-hmm. I didn't hate it because I was so inspired by Mr. Irons. V.E. Irons was an iconic figure back in the days when naturopaths and nutritionists were literally jailed. In fact, Mr. Irons was the sole importer of psyllium seed in the United States in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s before Metamucil, which is the psyllium seed's the main ingredient, Metamucil. And he was making health claims about fiber, all of which are true, but in the United States, it's illegal to make a health claim about a food. I mean, that's how the drug industries have these rules and regulations, these laws written. You cannot make a claim about a food improving a health condition, even if it's true. But Mr. Irons went back down, and they convicted him on 6 misdemeanors and sentenced him to a year in jail, and he served 6 months on good and was released on good behavior.
Wow.
And he's not the only one. The old-timers, they paid the dues by oftentimes ending up in jail for periods of time. Wow. It was a badge of honor to the old-timers. But I met Mr. Irons. He inspired me. He put me on his cleansing program. It was challenging. You know, it's not like you're a true fast because you do get some juices and you do get some fiber drinks, a lot of fiber drinks we call it the Roto-Rooter, you know, for cleaning out the colon.
Yeah.
And his supplements, which was basically Green Life, which was a wheatgrass concentrate with flax oil. He was selling flax oil in the 50s and the 60s before anybody was selling flax oil. And vitamin C. So you did get some nutrition, and you took a bunch of cleansing drinks throughout the whole program, and it filled you up, so that made it easier. But still, it was challenging because the real issue around fasting is more mental and psychological than it is physical. And by the way, that's one. And a year later, after doing 4 cleansing programs that summer, a year later, I had no allergies and no asthma. Boom. Uh-huh. So I knew I was on the right path, and that's actually what motivated me to get into this field full time. So
let's jump
forward.
Now, I love your story. I think it's really important. So let's jump forward. How many people are on that kind of a trail? You don't have to give me actual numbers, but there are great practitioners now on the alternative realms. Are there not?
Oh, there's so many now. Back then, it was like so rare to find an MD or a DO that was into nutrition. Even chiropractors then were hardly into nutrition. And so the change professionally is astonishing. I mean, I could never have imagined back when we started 40 some years ago that this whole situation would develop in the way that it has. And the public interest is even more astonishing. There's so much interest publicly and professionally now that just didn't exist then. I think it's a great sign. I'll be curious to see how the powers that be, you know, the drug companies and the food industry, how they manage this. There's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there that never was the case years ago. You can see that there's a clear attempt to try to dampen the enthusiasm around the field. But, man, once it's out and it's grassroots and the public is interested, I don't see anything but continued growth unless somehow the government steps in and really tries to clamp down on this industry.
Well, I think the public interest also comes from, for example, having a lot of boils and allergies and cleaning them up. You don't sit around and discuss whether that's true, do you? Even though that's testimonial, really, hey?
Right. It's another anecdote, you know.
Yeah.
But for me, the personal anecdote, it was a powerful, powerful personal anecdote. And I knew I was onto it, and that's all I needed. So,
and when I meet people now who've just turned themselves around, you can't stop them for love nor money.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it. And this is an out-of-pocket expense, this whole field. There's no insurance coverage. There's no, you know, second or third-party payers or anything like that. So even in light of that, which would ordinarily be considered a resistance um, or a a drawback. It hasn't dampened the growth of the field a bit. I mean, people, when it comes, you know, your health is your greatest wealth, isn't it true? I mean, mm-hmm. no matter.
Oh, you bet.
And as the older we get, the more we realize, boy, my health is my greatest wealth. So,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that was Mr. Iron's motto. Your health is your greatest wealth.
And it really is. But you notice lately we have this big rush on turmeric, for example. I keep laughing and going, wow, there was spice wars years ago. Now we know why, because a lot of these spices are absolutely amazingly powerful. But that is running through our society like nobody's business, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very encouraging. You know, hopefully they can maintain the quality of the turmeric, you know, because once, like with Golden Seal back in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, Golden Seal, which is a great herb, a fabulous anti-infective herb. I mean, in Jethro Kloss's famous book, Back to Eden, he was an herbalist back in there.
Back 1800. To Eden, I remember, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jethro Kloss, yeah, he was a famous herbalist, and he loved Golden Seal, and we used a ton of Golden Seal in our practice in the early days in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And then it was all over harvested, and all the wild Golden Seal was pretty well harvested, and so they started growing it in greenhouses, hothouses, and that, and it just never had the same potency.
So
about the herbs is the quality of the soil, you know. So, and unfortunately, that's another major player in the whole situation that we see ourselves in, you know, with the chemical agriculture, Monsanto, and you know, and other, you know, chemical agricultural companies that just dump and dump and dump chemicals by tonnage, you know, unbelievably large amounts of agricultural chemicals and food chemicals. And so the whole situation is altered. So I'm just hoping with all the turmeric enthusiasm, which is legit for sure, mm-hmm. We can somehow, hopefully most of it's grown in India, where it's been a native herb for a long, long time, and it's very medicinal and very tasty too. So mm-hmm. a neat herb.
You have to kind of get used to it. But I also just think you're right. The thing I see is it's all over the place. All kinds of people are getting amazing things, and it's probably going to get daunted by some chemicals at some point very soon, if not already.
Right? Well, there's a lot. Hopefully, there's enough emphasis on organic and soil quality, and you know, that it will maintain the quality of the herbs that are out there, especially the really popular herbs where the demand is so high. You know, those are the herbs that are at risk of being over-harvested.
Over-harvested is a good way to look at it, eh? That just means they start doing it in far too many smaller places and so on. Is that right?
Yeah, and especially in not that I'm opposed to greenhouses and that, but there's nothing quite like high-quality soil to grow high-quality plants. If it's grown in greenhouses or hydroponics or whatever, it's fine, but it doesn't carry the same medicinal qualities. And if you really broke it down chemically, I'm sure it would be revealed, because you can do analysis on that to measure the active ingredients.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Well, somebody told me once, not very long ago, that the greatest problem in eco, you know, the global warming and all that, is the loss of topsoil, that we
sure.
don't have enough topsoil, you know. Anyway, back to you. I shouldn't say anyway, but we don't want to go off into these other very deep and often tragic subjects, that part of life, right?
Right, and turmeric does kind of fit right into the brain health theme because, it's great for the brain, it's great for memory, it's a wonderful antioxidant throughout the body. And with brain diseases like Alzheimer's, you have inflammation in the brain. You know, you have type 3 diabetes in the brain. You know, the really exciting things that are happening to me in that field are basically the discovery of the ketogenic diet, which is not new. It was developed in the 1920s by the medical industry. I thought it was by Johns Hopkins. Somebody told me Mayo did it. I don't know exactly who developed the ketogenic diet, but
Wait a second. It's ketogenic? K-E-T-O?
K-E-T-O, right. Ketogenic. Okay. Keto meaning fat.
Oh,
ketones.
Okay.
When you burn, the body is capable of burning two types of fuel, glucose and ketones.
Okay.
So we know the glucose typically comes from carbohydrates. One way or another, the liver will break down fructose or maltose or dextrose or sucrose into glucose. And that can be hard on the liver, by the way, like, for example, with fructose. For the liver to convert fructose into glucose, because the body can only burn glucose, and table sugar is 50% glucose and 50% fructose, but for the liver to break down fructose into glucose is actually a very involved process that has undesirable consequences and side effects in liver function. which if you're into the chemistry, you can delve into that, but I'm just going to leave it at that. So, you know, and with the high fructose corn syrup and all the high fructose products that are on the market, you know, we've really stressed ourselves. And what happens in those types of situations is the body has to produce more and more insulin to accommodate the glucose load. And then because insulin is a pro-inflammatory hormone, when it's at too high of a level, and we know of insulin as carrying glucose into the cells. So in other words, the glucose in the blood combines with insulin, and the insulin carries the glucose into the cells, and the cells, you know, burn the glucose for energy. That's the normal thing. But when you're consuming so many carbs, like Americans have been, including alcohol, fructose especially, and there's a lot of fructose in beer, by the way,
mm-hmm.
You run into a situation where the body is producing more and more insulin to accommodate the glucose. But because insulin at high levels is a pro-inflammatory and can actually kill cells, the cells resist it. And so they call that insulin resistance. And then the insulin stays in the blood. It doesn't get into the cells, and so does the glucose. So with type 2 diabetes, you have elevated glucose and elevated insulin. Like with type 1, you just have elevated glucose. The person doesn't have any insulin. So that's the distinction between type 1.
And what's type 1. 3? You mentioned type 3. I've never heard of that.
Right. Well, that's the new phrase that's happening in certain circles. Type 3 is really just type 2 expanded into the brain. So the brain is the most, you know, is the biggest consumer of glucose in the body, has a voracious appetite for glucose. But the brain is perfectly capable of burning fat, too, or as ketones.
Mm-hmm.
So, but because the brain would burn glucose if it's there, when the high insulin and the high glucose enters the brain cells develop insulin resistance. They don't want to take in, you know, the glucose because there's too much insulin associated with it. And so the brain cells are experiencing type 2 diabetes, but they call it type 3 because it's specific to the brain here in this instance. But it's really just type 2 diabetes of the brain. So thus the phrase type 3.
Oh, and let me add something else. I was just listening to people talking about the fact that in dementia and a lot of older people, but also a lot of brain problems, the biggest problem is inflammation, which you've just been talking about. I'm going, wow. Yeah,
exactly. Excess insulin is a pro-inflammatory hormone, mm-hmm. and it will induce inflammation throughout the body, including the brain. And it will kill cells, and it will kill brain cells. And so Dr. Newport, you can see her videos on YouTube, you know, her husband had Alzheimer's, and he was flunking his cognitive tests. And she thought, she's an MD, she thought, you know, if he's not metabolizing glucose, because we know that's what's going on, I'm going to feed him ketones and see what happens. I'm going to shift him into a ketogenic approach. And so you cut his carbs way back, and she fed him a lot of coconut oil, which is loaded with ketones and medium-chain triglycerides, and he starts getting better. And like in 3 months, he's passing cognitive tests.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Newport, go to YouTube and video, search her videos.
Now, what's her name again?
Dr. Newport, N-E-W-P-O-R-T, Newport.
Okay.
I don't recall her first name.
But nice that it's a doctor, too, because I like to have some faith that doctors are also aware of what you're talking about, you know, the nutrition change like that.
Well, and then again, I'm just on YouTube looking at different videos, and then I see there's CBN, was at the Christian Broadcasting Network, Pat Robertson. He did a segment on this, and it was really well done. I highly recommend it. So he put one of his investigative reporters on this theme. And she did a great job reporting, and she dug into the research that's going on. So the drug companies are onto this. If they can find the medium-chain triglyceride that's ideal for the situation and concentrated and patented as a drug, you might see the pharmaceutical industry entering the whole ketogenic field. How that plays out. But Robertson covers it all on his CBN segment. It's about 7 minutes long, if I recall. And then they also expanded to include Parkinson's, et cetera. So... And by the way, before I forget, I saw this on Dr. Mercola's website, mercola.com, M-E-R-C-O-L-A.com, for your listeners who aren't aware of Dr. Mercola's website, which is the number one alternative health website in the world. They just did a segment on, was videoed, on putting headsets on people with Alzheimer's disease and playing music from their youth.
I think I saw that, Jim.
Amazing. It blew my mind. These people they start dialoguing, they start talking about it. It's like the music part of the brain is different than the typical memory part. I don't know enough about the brain to be more specific, But when and these people just opened up and started talking and started discussing what was going on in their life when that music was being, you know, when they were young and whatever. And it's not a cure. And it's the same thing with the coconut oil and the ketogenic. It's not a cure, but it's a treatment. And it's treatment that shows improvement. And there's another video on YouTube I saw with this Australian couple. Now, he has Alzheimer's. She doesn't. She's managing his care. And they find that if he does a tablespoon of coconut oil every 3 hours, he can maintain his memory through the day. But if he misses and he goes like 4 hours, his memory starts to fade.
Oh, wow.
So obviously, it's sure, but it is a treatment. So during that period of time, his brain is burning ketones. And that's what Dr. Newport figured out. She thought, well, I'm going to put him in a ketogenic diet and see how his brain responds to ketones. And she was shocked at how well he responded.
I bet she's thrilled. I can hardly wait to see the video.
Yeah, they're all over. And another thing you can do on YouTube is search coconut oil plus Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's oil, and the same kind of videos will come up. And you can see that Australian couple, and they'll talk about his experiences. And I mean, it's really encouraging. It doesn't cure anything, but it does give people some option as far as treatment goes. And
but is Alzheimer's is it being used as a kind of a clump, a whole bunch of different situations under that term, Alzheimer?
I don't quite follow the question.
Okay, there's a lot of different kinds of dementia or mental stress or PTSD and so on. They're not lumping them all under Alzheimer's, are they?
No, but they all respond to the brain burning different fuel. And the only way to sort that out is just to try it and see how the individual responds. Mm-hmm. The ketogenic diet was originally developed to treat seizure disorders, and it's incredibly effective. I mean, in fact...
It's incredibly effective for seizures?
Totally. It's virtually a complete for seizure disorders.
Hmm.
It's amazing. And now there are dietitians and nutritionists specializing in the ketogenic diet. It's made a big comeback. It was suppressed for over 50 years. And then the medical community just didn't want it out there, even though they knew it was very successful. But the drug companies wanted to develop all sorts of different drugs, you know, to treat the seizures. And
mm-hmm.
who is a Hollywood producer, I think he made the movie Ghost. And Meryl Streep, a friend of his, they did a 20-minute video that you can watch on YouTube where Zucker's child was seizure disordered severely.
Okay.
And the medications turned him into a zombie. You know, it was unacceptable. And so he learned about the ketogenic diet, implemented with his son, which completely cured his son. And then he and Meryl Streep did a 20-minute video on it. That if you type in Meryl Streep and seizure disorders, you can see the video. And, you know, it got a little bit of play when it was made 20 years ago. But, you know, it's really worth watching because they do a good job documenting the tremendous change. And then a bunch of other kids with seizure disorders were involved in this, too, and they documented the whole thing on video. It's really worth watching.
So with the same diet?
Yeah, it's a ketogenic diet, which mm-hmm. basically means your carbs are so low that there's not enough of an option to burn glucose, and so the body turns to ketones. And then you can feed specific ketones into that diet, like medium-chain triglycerides, which are about 15% of coconut oil. And you can also buy medium-chain triglyceride products that are all medium-chain triglycerides, because those are the ketones that burn the quickest and the most efficiently.
Hmm.
And you just shift the person ketogenic. It's remarkably therapeutic.
Wow. So what you're telling me right now is a whole bunch of kind of almost futuristic empowerment that we can use if we get into that lane, right?
Yeah, it is empowering. If you're motivated, you know, like I was so desperate with my boils, I didn't mention that when I was 14 with all these boils, they thought I had leukemia and they tested me for that and that was negative. So I had a couple of scares along the way when I was a kid, you know. But if you're motivated, and I was desperate. So I was motivated to follow Mr. Irons' recommendations, and the results were astonishing. And to this day, Karen and I always do a cleansing program every 3 months at the change of the seasons.
Hmm.
The other thing we do is we fast 2 days a week. We fast on Mondays and Thursdays, although you are technically allowed 500 calories on days of intermittent fasting. That's the new thing. You know, they call it intermittent fasting. And again, Mercola has done a lot of outstanding articles on intermittent fasting, as many others have as well.
That's either and 1 or 2 days a week or...
Yeah, 1 or 2 days a week, and there's different approaches. Dr. Mercola likes the 18-6 approach, you know, fast for 18 hours, eat within a six-hour window. What I have found with my clients is that six-hour window can be abused, and you can really undo all the benefits of the 18 hours if you don't have any control of your, you know, your appetite or whatever.
I can
so
see.
I do better.
Sorry, I just had this huge vision of somebody stuffing in burgers and ice cream while they had their little break there.
Yeah, you can do a lot of damage in 6 hours if you're not disciplined. So I just do much. I do much better fasting for 24 hours. And here's another thing about fasting, because it's also been a bit of a breakthrough, even though the old timers all taught fasting. And even the religions, you know, you got the Ramadan fast in Islam, you've got the Sabbath fast in Judaism and Christianity, the Buddhists, you know, all into fasting, the Hindus, they were, all the religions of the world.
Catholics do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, when I was raised Catholic, it was no meat on Friday. That was the excuse for not fasting on Saturday. Friday.
When I was raised Catholic, I think there were special days that it was recommended you fasted, but I didn't do much of that.
Right, and then you had the Lenten fast, you know, and things like that and whatever. And that was actually my first experience with a kind of semi-fasting was Lent. I would, like, give up sugar during Lent, and I was always really empowered when I did that. I just felt, you know, it had some kind of a psychological effect that empowered me. The idea of not eating food wasn't, at that time, wasn't very forefront in my consciousness, but I found it interesting to restrict certain things during Lent, and I felt some victories, you know, doing that. And by the way, fasting, the University of Southern California has done tremendous research on fasting, and they're finding that if you are willing to fast for 4 days on water, it regenerates your stem cells, you know, where all the cells are made.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
Rejuvenates mitochondria, which are the little units of in the cells that burn energy, burn calories, and produce ATP. Hmm. The mitochondria, the energy-producing bodies in the cells. And some cells have a few and some cells have many mitochondria. But as we get older, the mitochondria, they lose efficiency and they get backlogged with their own waste products. And fasting completely clears and rejuvenates the mitochondria and the stem cells. And it's the only thing ever discovered, confirmed, you know, beyond any doubt, that it will regenerate mitochondria and stem cells. You know, when you look at human history, we all went, you know, historically, we went through times of feast and famine, times of abundance, times of lack. And so if you look at thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of years of human experience, fasting has been a part of that for a lot longer than abundant food has been available all the time like we have now.
Well, and how do you feel not wanting to shift out of that? That's all really interesting. And now how do you and Karen feel when you fast?
Fantastic. I mean, that's the thing. Once you go into ketosis, once you start burning fat for energy, you feel so good.
Really?
So strong.
Really?
So mentally. Yeah, this is a terrible thing for me to say, but I'll say it. I sometimes have referred to it as the anorexic buzz. I mean, you know, and I don't mean in any way to make light of anorexia or bulimia. I mean, it's big time stuff. But I know what it's like to feel so good after not eating for 7 days that you say to yourself, "Boy, I don't know if I want to eat again." I mean, I've had that experience many times.
Really?
Eat, and it's a bit of a letdown. And it's like, because you shift your body out of ketosis, you go back into burning glucose, and then you have the blood sugar fluctuations and all the things that go along with glucose metabolism, depending upon the individual.
Hmm.
But, yeah, you feel so good and so clear and so energetic on a fast once you hit ketosis. So here's what happens on a fast. First day, in theory, you're supposed to burn glycogen. Glycogen is stored sugar, stored glucose, primarily by the liver, stores it in the liver and the muscles. And glycogen is your reserve fuel. And in theory, you should have 24-hour reserve of glycogen. Some people do, some people don't. So that's what you burn first. You burn up your glycogen. Then you go to what's called gluconeogenesis, which is when your body's burning protein for energy. Now, when the body burns protein, it breaks it down to glucose. So that's why protein and carbohydrates both have 4 calories per gram. Because if your body's going to burn protein, it first breaks the protein down into glucose.
Oh,
so
okay.
Gluconeogenesis, that's the break. And your body will do that for about 2 days. And then it kind of gets the message like, hey, we don't want to waste any more protein. You know, muscles, tissues, too important. So let's start burning fat. And then about the third day, depending upon the individual, fourth day, they'll go into ketosis, and you can go into slight, moderate, or deep ketosis, and that will build as time goes on. And that's when you shift. For me, the first day I always feel good because I have enough glycogen to get me through that day. Then when you go into gluconeogenesis, I don't feel that good for days 2 and 3, But I know those are transition days, and then in day four or late day three, I go into ketosis, and it's just the whole, everything just clicks, and you feel so good and so energetic.
Is it ever hard to do this?
It is sometimes, and what I've learned too, because I'm an experienced faster, is that if I start a fast and it's a struggle, I stop it, and I wait a week and I start again. I've given up the rigidity because I don't know all the angles involved or all the subtleties. Why sometimes you start a fast and it's just a breeze. Every day is easy. The first day is a breeze. You have good momentum before you know it, and you're on day four before you know it. Other times, it's like a struggle. And now in the old days, I used to struggle through the struggle and try to force it, and it was so difficult. And then I learned, you know, just take a break. Who knows? The old timers said that you should always start a fast when the moon is waxing, not when it's waning. I can't say that I ever really noticed a difference in that regard personally, but they insisted on it. You know, the old time fasters, sure. they would say always start a fast when the moon is waxing. I don't know the variables there, but there are variables. And if it's a struggle for me, I stop, I wait a week, I start again, wait a couple days, start again, whatever. If it's easy and I've got good momentum, then I'm going to play it out right away. So, yeah, it varies. And I wish I could give you, something definitive as to what's going on and why that varies, but it does.
Well, you know, I was reading a thing also that said if you don't sleep well, which I never have, it says that you don't then clean out the plaque in your brain. And I also was reading this stuff about inflammation in the brain and dementia and all that. And I'm listening to you and I'm going, will the fasting actually release the plaque from the brain?
It certainly will. The fasting is really another way of saying aggressive detoxification.
Mm-hmm.
And that will clear the brain of plaque, amyloid plaque, and, you know.
It is possible, though, to clear it that way, huh?
Yes, it is. In fact, you know, at the co-op class here in Bellingham that you've taken, mm-hmm. Or you've been to, we added
that
the brain
I recommend
health.
For anybody who's anywhere near Bellingham.
we added a brain health class to the sequence.
Oh, you
and
did.
And one of the big things we emphasize is sleep. And Dr. McCullough has done a lot of good work with that too. And here's the thing about the brain: they used to think that the lymphatic system of the body had no access to the brain. Now, the lymphatic system of the body is that fluid, that clear, viscous kind of fluid, like if you squeeze a pimple or if you scrape yourself and you see that clear fluid,
sure.
That's lymph.
Mm-hmm.
And lymph is lymphocytes, white blood cells. There's a lot of white blood cells in lymph fluid. It's coordinated by the spleen, just like the liver coordinates the blood. And, in Chinese medicine, the spleen is the mother and the liver is the father. And they're the first two internal organs to develop after the neural tube or the spinal column and brain develop, you know, in utero. First two internal organs that develop are the liver and the spleen, and the mother and the father. And the spleen is how the immune system reaches out and circulates throughout the entire body. And so the whole emphasis on the cleaning the brain, if it doesn't have a lymphatic system, well, how does the brain clean and detoxify? But now, recently, in the last year or two, they've discovered that there's an aggressive connection between the lymphatic system and the brain, and they're calling it the glymphatic system, G-L-Y-M, glymphatic, like glia, you know,
okay.
For the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So glymphatic system is the lymphatic system in the brain, and that's what clears out the amyloid plaque and the debris, the waste products that accumulate in the brain from the brain's metabolism. And like you indicated, it's like 8 times more aggressive when you're sleeping, or more active, I should say. So the glymphatic system, or the brain's lymphatic system, is much more active during sleep. And that's why sleep is so crucial for brain health and for the health of the whole body. I mean, there's no disputing it. But now they're making the connection to the brain health. And one of the things that characterizes our culture is a lack of adequate sleep. We're in a sleep-deprived culture.
Yeah, we are, actually. And we don't even know how to rest most of the time.
Exactly.
We're always racing around doing something. But that's actually very, very interesting. I will come to your brain class at some point, or perhaps we can do one online together.
Oh, yeah, that would be fun. I mean, or, you know, you could even tape the class.
Yeah, that would be very, very good, because I'm talking about my brain in a way, but I know a lot of people. And a lot of memory stuff, a lot of this technology that's overwhelming the brain, just too much information is overwhelming the brain, toxicity in the food is overwhelming the brain, right?
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I should mention, because I know we're probably tight on time.
We are.
For aging healthy adults, that don't have Alzheimer's but are experiencing kind of aging dementia, you know, not necessarily
memory and so on.
Mm-hmm. Normal so-called aging memory loss.
Mm-hmm.
They did a study using standard process Ginkgo. Ginkgo Synergy is the name of their product,
okay.
And choline. And they gave aging healthy adults with some memory concerns, typical concerns, two doses of ginkgo and choline a day. First, they tested them initially. They did cognitive tests. Then they put these people on ginkgo and choline for 2 months, and they retested them. And they had tremendous memory improvement in 2 months taking ginkgo and choline. Now, this isn't an Alzheimer's formula. And I have also found that if I don't use Standard Process's brand, and I don't have any association or affiliation with Standard Process, I have no economic involvement with them at all, although I know they're a great company, I see that their ginkgo is a real dark brown. And when I buy other ginkgos, they're light tan. So here again, it's herbal quality.
I wonder why that is, huh?
I think it's the soil. I think it's how it's grown, you know, as far as the color and the concentration of the, you know, whatever active ingredients are in the plant. But I wanted to mention that, and I copied that article, and I can send you a copy of it if you wish, but they use ginkgo and choline, both by Standard Process, 60-day trial, and had tremendous results.
Wow,
so,
I want to know that. I've got a lot of people that will want to know that, too.
Do that that attachment, absolutely.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Jim Emke. And as I always say near the end of our conversation, well, this is just the beginning. We could talk forever on a million things here.
Sure.
And sure. I do see your work. I do see your work as a health detective and somebody who's always researching the latest things. It's kind of staying with the cutting edge of where people are willing to take charge of their own health. I really appreciate that about you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's very nice of you to mention that. Take control of your health. I mean, that's the theme that we all want to work with, and that's the theme Dr. Mercola is working with, and that's the theme that we use at our classes at the co-op here in Bellingham, and it empowers people. Take control of your health. Your health is your greatest wealth, and if you don't take control of it, then it's just a guessing game.
That's right. Now tell people how to get hold of you.
Well, my website is goodtothelastdrop.com.
Because we didn't even get into structured water. That's next time, I guess.
Oh, my gosh, we can get into structured water. Well, another time, because I'm a big fan of structured water. So it's goodtothelastdrop.com, and that name came out of the fact that it's we do a lot of water work on that website. And no numbers, all letters, small case, goodtothelastdrop.com. Or my number is 360-734-9777.
And sometimes you can find him giving a class at the co-op, at the Bellingham Food Co-op, community co-op, right?
We start another series in September.
Super. They're really wonderful classes. Thank you so much, Jim Emke, and thank you, everyone, for listening to Paradigm Shifters. I hope you're taking good care of your own health. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, see you again. VeronicaEntwistle.com for this podcast as well. Thank you.